Let's open our Bibles to the 19th chapter of the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 19. We will not make it all the way through the chapter tonight because there's a lot in this chapter, little pun intended, of course. It was a bizarre chapter in chapter 18, wasn't it? Just a crazy, insane chapter. And so the bizarreness is going to continue on into chapter 19. Now, you remember that the scene of chapter 18 is that you've got the encampment of Abraham. And he is there in the plains of Mamre. He would be south and southwest of what we would know as Jerusalem. And there were three characters that showed up. Now, two of those characters are mysterious. They're kind of shrouded in mystery. And we're going to be told here in chapter 19 twice that they were angels. Now, that word angel, it just means messenger. Now, it could be that they were spirit beings, as we think of when we hear the term angel. But I suppose that it could be that they were human, that they were prophets, and God was using them to be his messenger to the city of Sodom. But as the story unfolds in chapter 19, we're going to see that what goes on there sort of leans us in the direction that these were probably some kind of spiritual beings. But be that as it may, they're shrouded in mystery. But the one character, there is no mystery whatsoever who he is, because in verse 1, we're told the Lord appeared unto him. That would be Abraham. And then you remember we read in verse 26, and the Lord replied, that is, replied to Abraham, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. And when you see that, the translators are letting you know, this is not a term of respect. It isn't that he's just looking at somebody and thinking, oh, you know, you're an awesome guy. But the word would be Jehovah or Yahweh or however you choose to pronounce it. The ever-existing one, the self-existing one, the God of gods and the Lord of lords, all right? So the God of gods comes into the encampment of Abraham, has a nice lunch with Abraham, and gets up from lunch. And you remember that the two angels are with him. And these are the Lord's two gunslingers, all right? And they're going to be sent on eastward into Sodom. And so as they now are leaving the encampment of Abraham, they're heading to the east. The sun now, we're well into the afternoon. It was the heat of the day when they showed up. And so now we're well on into the day. The sun is at their back. They're walking eastward. And the Lord stays behind and begins to have that very fascinating conversation with Abraham. So we pick it up now in verse 1 that the gunslingers have finally made their way to the city of Sodom. And so we read in verse 1 that the two angels came to Sodom in the evening. And Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose up to meet them and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Now, he does exactly what Abraham had done. Chapter 18, you remember, Abraham sees the three coming at him from a great distance. He gets up, he goes out there, he bows before them. Now, Lot does the same thing. So, again, we're kind of curious. What is there about these guys? Is it their dress? Was there something that just signified to both Lot and Abraham that these are big deal, all right? These are a big deal and very, very important people. Now, notice that we are now told that they got there in the evening. Now, this doesn't mean it's nighttime. The gates of the city are still open, so no doubt the sun was setting. Now, what's interesting about this is that you remember that they were in the plains of Mamre. And now Sodom and Gomorrah, though we do not know the exact location, somewhere in that southern region of the Dead Sea. And so conservatively speaking, it's 20, 25, maybe a 30-mile walk. I've seen some guys put it at 50 miles. But just being conservative and just saying, all right, it's 25 miles, the average human being walks about 3 miles an hour, all right? So it's late in the afternoon there. You remember, it's the heat of the day. They're going to make lunch, and so Sarah is grinding grain. I mean, she is starting from scratch with this lunch. She grinds the grain, she makes the flour, she's making the dough, and she bakes the bread. Abraham is going out into the pasture, grabbing a calf. The calf's got to be butchered. So this process, no doubt, took an hour or two at least, and then they eat it there, and then they have this little conversation, and then they take off. So no doubt, the afternoon is well on. Now, before the setting of the sun, these guys have now traveled 25, 30 miles. They are moving at a pretty good clip, are they not? Now, it could be that these were Kenyan prophets that ran marathons. We don't know. Or it could be that they're spiritual beings. I think that we're kind of pushed to the side of them being spiritual beings here. So they get there. Now, isn't it interesting that Lot is now at the gate of the city? What this would indicate is that Lot is a leader. Lot is a well-respected individual in this town. Those who are in the gates of the city, they would conduct the role of being a judge. If you were having problems with your neighbor, you just go down to the gate of the city and you talk to one of the big shots down there, and they would pass some sort of a judgment, and then the problem would be solved. They were also like a TSA agent. You show up, you want to get in town. Who are you? Where are you from? What business do you have here? What do you got to sell? And so these were the gatekeepers, so to speak. So he is in a very prominent position, which is interesting. Because the last time we read of this guy, you remember, in chapter 13, Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and he pitched his tent toward Sodom. And now all of a sudden, notice, he's in Sodom. It starts out, and this is the way we decline in our faith. This is the way that we leave our devotion to God. It doesn't happen all at once. It is an incremental thing that takes place in our life. He sets his tent towards Sodom. He's looking at Sodom every day. We're the kind of creatures that if we're looking at it, we want it, right? I go to the boat show, I want a boat. I go to the auto show, I want an automobile. I go to the gun show, I want a gun. You go to a Pampered Chef party, you want Pampered Chef stuff, right? I mean, whatever you look at, that tends to be what we want. And so here he is every day, just looking at this city and being intrigued by it. I wonder what they do down there. And I wonder what it's like to live there. And then all of a sudden, he's there. But this is not a good experience for him, because Peter gives us great insight in chapter 2 of 2 Peter that the Lord rescued righteous. I find that very intriguing. Righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked. I mean, every day he's bugged. Every day he feels guilty. Every day he's looking at this crap that's going on around him. But he's stuck there. We're going to see that his wife is not too interested in leaving. His daughters have now been married off to citizens of Sodom. You see, I mean, that's what happens. We get drug into this stuff, and we think, well, I'll just be there for a short period of time, and it ends up becoming our own lifestyle, and we feel guilty, and we feel bugged by it, because we have no idea how in the world are we ever going to get out of this mess that we find ourselves in. Well, of course, the only way that we are going to get out is the Lord is going to drag us out of whatever mess we are in. And so we then read in verse 2 that he said unto them, now, hear now, my lords, please, you turn into your servant's house and spend the night, wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way. And they said, no, but we will spend the night in the open square. We're going to spend the night in the city park. But he insisted strongly that they turn into him and entered into his house. And then he made them a feast, and he baked unleavened bread, and they ate it. Now, every day, this guy's soul is vexed. Every day, he's feeling guilty. Every day, he just can't believe how wicked these people are. But he doesn't know what to do about it. And when these guys say they're going to just camp out in the city park. No. You don't want to do that. Now, how much he knows about these guys, it's really hard to say. I really don't think at this point that he quite understands the spiritual nature of themselves and also of their mission. And so he's thinking two new guys, fresh meats come into town. They're going to be camping out there. It's going to be easy pickings. No. You got to be behind locked doors in this city, let me tell you. So I insist, you are going to come home with me. Well, then it gets bizarre in verse 4. And before they were to lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house. And they called Lot and they said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally." Well, that's different, isn't it? I mean, imagine reading this for the first time. I mean, it's like, what? What in the world is going on here? Now, the pro-gay theologian will say that this doesn't have anything to do with homosexuality. Now, in a sense, they're right in that this isn't a story about two guys with same-sex attraction that want to have a relationship with each other. That's not what's going on here. I mean, this is an act of rape. This is an act of violence that is taking place here. But for crying out loud, how can you say that it's not homosexual when it is the gang rape of two men by a group of men? Now, you've got to get this scene in your mind. Sodom was not New York City. Sodom was not even Fort Wayne, Indiana. Sodom was not even Leo, all right? You're talking about a very small walled village. You're talking about a community probably well short of 1,000 people. Now, they have found some mass graves in this southern region of the Dead Sea that where they were buried, I think, by the event we're going to be reading about here in a moment. And it numbers around 20,000. But that would be, remember, there's several towns in this area, and you've got all of these Bedouins and sheep herders and all of this. So the whole area, they estimate that there's probably about 20,000 people buried in this mass grave. So in the city itself, you're probably talking about a rather large crowd. You're talking about a crowd of maybe 200-300 guys. Now, what I find intriguing here is that notice that we're told there that it was both old and young. So every demographic, every male demographic is represented here. You're talking about grandpa is there. And when it says young, understand that this is taking us all the way down to toddlers, all right? So understand how sick and twisted this situation is, where you've got grandpa and you've got the toddlers, you've got all of the males in town there. And what are they there for? They are there to observe and they are there to participate in the gang rape of two new guys that have just stumbled into town. Now, this is what their culture was. Now, we understand that the earlier that sexuality is introduced into the male brain, the more difficult it is for the male to untangle the subject of sexuality. One research tells us that experience of sexual abuse as a child more than tripled the likelihood of later reporting homosexual orientation. In the Journal of the National Medical Association, they tell us that boys who have been sexually abused are 7 times more likely to identify as homosexual or bisexual than their heterosexual counterparts. The same study tells us this, that boys who later identified as heterosexual had a mean average of 15.7 years as the time of their first sexual experience, where boys who later identified as homosexual, the mean age was 12.7 years of age. So the way that the male brain is wired is that the earlier you're introducing this activity to that brain, the more difficult it's going to be for that brain to begin to straighten out some of these issues as they age. Now, here is a culture, and how many generations generations this has been going on. We have no idea at all. How many generations have, you know, I would bring my little boy to the meeting. You'd bring your little boy to the meeting. I'd have sex with your little boy. You'd have sex with my little boy. And this has been going, we know that people that molest children, there is a very high likelihood that they themselves were molested. And so this has no doubt gone on for generations. It is a culture. Now, it fascinates me how we are living in this politically correct culture of ours where we are not allowed to say that one culture is inferior or one culture happens to be better than another culture. Maybe you read the article in the New York Times this week. It made me want to puke. But you remember these two special forces guys. One was the Bronze Star. Both of them were driven out of the military because there was a young Afghan mother that showed up at their base with her young Afghan son. And they were both beaten up. And the mom said that, look, the commander that you put in charge of our town chained my son to his bed and has been raping my son. And so these two special forces, doing what any man would do, went and paid the commander a little visit, all right, and kind of exhorted him to stop doing those kinds of things. And because of that, they get run out of the military and the guy still keeps his job. And our military leaders are saying to these special forces, they're saying they hear the screams of the little boys at night. They bring the little boys to the American bases and rape them there. And their commanders are saying, no, you can't step in. That's a cultural, it's their culture. Well, your culture sucks and it needs to be destroyed, right? And that's exactly what God is doing to this culture here. It is beyond repair. It is now to the point where they're so sick and twisted that the whole city is showing up to witness and to participate in this gang rape. And God said, this is it, man. You guys, I'm going to light this place up. Your culture deserves to be damned, and that's exactly what I'm going to do to it right now. Well, then he goes on to say this in verse 6. He says, and so Lot went out to them through the doorway, and he shut the door behind him, and he said, now please notice this, my brothers, these are your buddies. This is what you hang out with. I mean, do you understand how compromised the man has become? Do you understand how down this guy is and how he's being crushed by this culture that he can look at these perverts and say, brother, really? Perverts are your brother's lot? Is that what's going on here now? And so he says, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See now, I have two daughters that have not known a man. Now, please, let me bring them out to you that you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason that they have come under the shadow of my roof. I mean, how compromised, how sick must Lot himself be that he is offering his virgin daughters into a gang rape situation? I mean, you can just see how far gone, how out of control this situation is. Now, notice what the perverts say to him in verse 9. They said, stand back. And then they said, this one has come to stay here, and he keeps acting like a judge. You notice that's what perverts say? You're judging me. Quit judging me. Well, you know what, dude? You need to be judged, all right? Because you're sick and twisted. So he's always judging us. Now, we may deal worse with you than with them. And so they pressed hard against the man Lot, and they came near to break down the door. But the men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men which were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great. Notice this. And so they became weary trying to find the door. So now they're saying, look, we're sick of you, all right? Now, maybe some of these guys got a raw deal as Lot was down there judging. Maybe he judged some of their cases, and they didn't like the way that he judged them. So now these guys are saying, man, when we get done with them, we're gonna rape you, dude, and we're gonna be worse with you than we are with those two guys. And so, again, stupid Lot. I mean, he gets yanked back into the house here, and these guys strike the crowd with blindness. Now, notice that they are so driven by their sexual desires. I mean, they're like zombies. I mean, do you understand? They're like zombies. They are just so focused on the orgasm that they have no clue that they've been blinded. I mean, isn't that weird? I mean, don't you think, hey, I can't see. Hey, can you guys see? I can. I mean, instead of that, they're like zombies trying to find the door here so that they can get in and have sex with these men. I mean, these guys are just gone, all right? Well, then we read in verse 12, and the men, they said to Lot, now, have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever is in the city, now you take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord. And the Lord has sent us to destroy. And so Lot, he went out. Now he can go out because everybody's blind, right? Marco Polo, one of those things. And so he goes out there and he went out and he spoke with his sons-in-law who had married his daughters. So he's got daughters in the house that are virgins. He's got daughters that are now married. They got their families there and married a nice boy from Sodom and said, now get up and get out of this place where the Lord will destroy the city. And notice, but to his sons-in-law, it seemed like he was joking. Now, this is what compromise does. Do you understand that compromise takes away any authority that you might have to impact the lives of others? Notice he's speaking truth. He is telling them exactly what God has said and exactly what God is going to do. But notice, it has no penetration. It is not affecting these guys. Oh, you're a joker. We can't take you seriously, man. This guy has become so compromised that he is no longer an effective witness for the Lord. So they're not listening. Now, this is amazing. Verse 15. To me, it's one of the most amazing verses in all the Bible. And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, the men took a hold of his hand and his wife's hand and the hands of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful, I guess so. And they brought him out and they set him outside the city. Now, you read that first line. When it was morning, excuse me, what? They are there in the evening. He says, get out. We're going to light this baby up, all right? Now, if angels showed up at your house and there's some sort of a threat coming your way and they extinguish that threat by causing everybody to be blind and then they look at you and say, hey, get out of Dodge right now. Would you then turn to your wife and say, well, you know, if we're going to make a run for it, we probably need a good night's sleep, all right? And so, I mean, who can sleep? I mean, first of all, what is he doing all night long? What is going on there? And then as he lingers, is he making flapjacks for breakfast? I mean, what is going on? These guys, would you get moving? Come on. And so one angel, no doubt, grabbed his hand and his wife's hand. The other angel probably grabbed the two kids' hand and dragging them, you know, out of the city here. Now, you understand the problem with this guy is that there's just no urgency here. There's no sense of urgency. And this is what prosperity and this is what compromise does to us. It just robs us of our sense of urgency. How many of us really can say that we've got an eternal perspective? How much of our conscious thoughts concern those things that are eternal? Do we really understand? Now, here's the balance. Now, God has given us all things freely to enjoy. God has blessed us, right? You've got great blessings in your life. I've got great blessings in my life. And we should enjoy these blessings. But at the same time, do we understand that everything we see is temporal? Everything we buy is temporal. Everything that we participate in, it is essentially temporal if it is not involving loving God or loving his people. Everything, Peter says, is going to burn away with a fervent heat. Therefore, what manner of men ought we to be? If we understand everything I see is going to be burnt to a crisp, What kind of a man should I be? I should be the kind of man that lives on the edge of my seat. Be the kind of man that there's a sense of urgency. I don't have 1,000 years in front of me. I don't have all of the time in the world. But what happens is that prosperity comes in, it makes us soft. It starts introducing that compromise, and we just lose that sense that we're just passing through. And we start settling down, and we start seeing this as our home. And we start making our 20 and our 30 and our 50-year plans, and we, you know, all of these things. Now, granted, you got a plan for your retirement, but at the same time, there has to be that thought, look, tomorrow God might interrupt my life. Tomorrow, this day might be the last day of my life. Therefore, how am I to live? Lot was not living that way. No urgency. And the lack of urgency, it just took a sharp edge off. And how many of us, our sharp edge has been taken off? There was a time in our life where, man, we had a passion for Jesus. And God blessed us, right? And God has done marvelous things in our life. But then those blessings, they begin to weaken our resolve. They begin to weaken and dull our sharpness. And that's what happened to this guy. Well, then notice we read in verse 17. And so it came to pass that when they had brought them outside, that he said, now escape for your life. Now look, an angel is looking at him and saying, escape for your life, dude. Are you going to sit around and talk? That's what Lot does. Notice, do not look behind you. And don't stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountain. All right, get out of here and get to high ground. Very interesting. You've got to get to high ground. And notice then Lot. Lot said, well, please, my lords, indeed now, I your servant, have found a favor. And in your sight, you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. Now, see now that there's this city. It's near enough to flee, and it's a little one. It's just a little bitty city. So send me to the little bitty city, and is it not a little one? I'm sure at this point they want to put a sandal up his rear end, I would imagine. And my soul, it shall live. And so he said unto him, now you see that I have favor for you concerning this thing also, in that I will not overthrow this city which you have spoken. Now hurry, escape. I mean, this guy, would you hurry up, right? And this guy just dragging his way, lollygagging around, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Now therefore, the name of that city is called Zoar. And the sun was risen upon the earth as Lot entered into Zoar, and the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. And so he overthrew those cities of the plain and all of the inhabitants of the city. And notice what grew on the ground. So vast areas of vegetation have been destroyed by this as well. But notice his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, all of us, I think all of us probably this week have been living in sin. I think all of us have been living in willful disobedience to the command of Jesus. Because you remember that Jesus said a very interesting thing in Luke's gospel. He said, remember, present tense, you keep on remembering, you do not forget this, you keep this in the forefront of your mind. Remember Lot's wife. Now, how many of us this week thought about Lot's wife when the Lord said, I never want you to forget her. You keep Lot's wife right in the forefront of your mind. Now, here is a woman, right? She doesn't want to leave. She's looking behind, and the Hebrew indicates that she's looking longingly. She wants to go back. Now, understand, when they pulled out of Sodom, it was an ordinary day. when they pulled out of Sodom, the sun was shining, the birds were chirping, she could hear the construction projects going on inside the city. It was an ordinary day. You remember that Jesus said that his second coming is not only going to be as the days of Noah, but they would also be as the days of Lot. And you remember that Jesus said, likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. And so here she was. She's walking out of the city. She's like, this is stupid. This is so stupid. I can't believe we're doing this. We are leaving our very pleasant. Yeah, there's a gang rape every now and then, but you got to take the good with the bad, right? And you know, she's leaving. She's got family back there. She's got two daughters. Maybe she's got grandchildren. We don't know. And here are these idiotic strangers dragging her by the hand. And she's just, no, I don't want to leave. This is home. Now look, when Sodom is home to you, you got some issues, all right? And so she turns around and she's lingering now, you see? And this judgment now hits her in some way. Now people will say, oh, now come on. I mean, really, we're 21st century people. Do you really expect me to believe that this woman was turned into a pillar of salt? Well, listen to what Josephus, the historian, said. He said, she was changed into a pillar of salt. I've seen it, and it remains at this day. All right? It's right there. I can take you down to it, and you can see the woman in this pillar of salt. And then Clement of Rome, he said that she was made an example of so as to be a pillar of salt unto this day. And then Irenaeus said that the pillar exists to this very day. So here she is. She is just, no, this is stupid. I don't want to leave. I'm not believing what I'm being told here. I'm not going to follow my husband. And she turns back and she's destroyed. The things that we love that are not of God will do to us. They will destroy. Be careful what you love. She loved the wrong thing, and it destroyed her. Well, then finally, verse 27. And Abraham, he went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all of the land of the plain. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land which went up like the smoke of a furnace. So this is intense. Somebody's burning tires over there, right? And it came to pass that God destroyed the cities of the plain, and that God remembered Abraham, and he sent Lot out in the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. And then Lot went up out of Zoar, and he dwelt in the mountains, right? He just had to go there. And now he leaves, and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar. And he and his two daughters, they dwelt there in the cave. Now, this is interesting. Now, what happened in Zoar? Now, imagine now, you live in Zoar, and all of a sudden, here comes the guy and his two daughters, and there's a mushroom cloud behind them, all right? And where are you from, partner? Well, back here with a mushroom cloud just yet. And maybe they're thinking, hey, God was shooting for you and miss, and maybe he's going to retarget and going to drop one of those right here on our fine city. Maybe there was some sort of murmuring going on. We don't like this guy from Sodom. And so he, you know, he's a little on edge, right? And so he's thinking, well, I'm out of here. Maybe I'll go to the mountains where they told me to go in the first place. Now, archaeology has provided some very interesting information about this event. This is known as the Sumerian Planisphere. Now, this was found in the ruins of Nineveh. It was actually found in one of the libraries of Nineveh. It now resides in the British Museum of History. And this was made by a highly intelligent individual. It is a person that is observing his night sky. Now, how this was made, this is a replication of it. It's in somewhat of a bowl shape. The wet clay would have been placed into this bowl, and the bowl would be like a clipboard. You can't write on just a piece of paper, so he put a clipboard behind it, and you can't write on a wet piece of clay, and so they would put it in this bowl. Now, this individual is describing for us, and we even know the date. It was June 29th. He is describing for us what the night sky looked like. Now, this is so exact, they believe he was using some kind of advanced instrumentation. And when you look at this thing, for example, here on the lower left, you have the constellation Gemini. Up in the upper right, you have the constellation Pisces. Down towards the center, you have the planet Mercury. You then have the planet Jupiter. And you'll notice there's a very interesting object that is moving through and is well in front of the constellation of Pisces. As they look at all of this, they have concluded that it was an asteroid about the size of 3/4 of a mile, right? So he's watching this. Now, researchers have put all of these figures into computers, and they have simulated this night sky and this asteroid, and they believe that this asteroid passed right over the top of what we would know as the cities of the plain. And what happened was, is that there was this airburst. It didn't make contact, but it exploded. Now, there were one of these that exploded in Tunguska, Siberia in 1905, 1908, I think. And it just destroyed, just hundreds of miles. I mean, it just flattened everything. And researchers believe that what this asteroid did is that it exploded. Of course, it who knows how hot this thing was as it was coming through the Earth's atmosphere. And then the plume of the explosion rose up, and then it went backward following its entry, the way that it made its entry into the Earth. And it would have taken, you know, millions of tons of this fiery debris, and it would have dumped it all right there on the city of the plains. Now, what is also interesting is that this map was discovered in Jordan a number of years ago. And what's interesting about this map, now this map is, this would be the Dead Sea. So the map is we would think of it as lying on its side. North would be to the left, south would be to the right, east would be above, and west would be down below. And what's fascinating is that on this map is a little town that is called Zoar. Now, this is the first time that this city has ever been mentioned outside or ever found outside of a biblical reference. So again, it's like Pontius Pilate, it's like King David, it's like a number of these people that are mentioned and cities that are mentioned, and skeptics have said, well, because we can't find it in archaeology, it doesn't exist. But lo and behold, eventually the archaeologist comes across it. And what is also fascinating is just above it, it says Lot's Sanctuary. And so archaeologists, they took this map and they followed this map, and they eventually ended right here in a cave with this building in front of it that dates back to who knows where. And no doubt this is the very cave where Lot and his daughters were seeking refuge. Now, why did the Lord destroy the city of Sodom? Now, there are some, again, gay theologians that will say, well, it was because they weren't polite. It was because of inhospitality. Now, I'm sorry, it seems like a bit of an overreaction, doesn't it? You know, you're just a little impolite and God just destroys it. I mean, if you invite me to your home and you're not nice to me and I pull out a gun and shoot you, probably an overreaction, right? And they always want to point out Ezekiel chapter 16. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. They were haughty, and they did detestable things before me. Therefore did I away with them, as you have seen. But Jude gives us great insight here. Jude tells us this: and don't forget Sodom and Gomorrah and their neighboring towns, which were filled with immorality and every kind of sexual perversion. Those cities were destroyed by fire, and they serve as a warning of eternal fire of God's judgment. Now look, they were full of themselves. They were at ease. They were prosperous. They were filled with selfishness. And because of that, they threw off every restraint of God, restraint of their own conscience. And they got involved with all kinds of self-destructive behavior. It started out with an attitude. I mean, look, all actions start with an attitude, right? You cop an attitude. I'm better. I know more. I'm whatever. I deserve this. It starts with an attitude, and then the actions begin to follow. And that's what happened in Sodom. And so these actions had been going on for so long. They are beyond redemption. They are beyond repair. They are so sick and twisted. They were a self-destructive, suicidal culture anyway, and God destroyed them. But understand this, there is something worse than Sodom. You understand? We think of Sodom and Gomorrah, oh, what a terrible place. And it was. But there's something worse than Sodom. And you remember that Jesus was warning these towns that were rejecting the truth of the gospel. They had a presentation of the gospel. They knew the genuineness of the gospel. And what did Jesus say to them? I tell you the truth. The wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah will be better off than such a town on the day of judgment. The individual, the community, the culture that has had a clear presentation of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it has been verified with signs and wonders and prayer being answered and all kinds of things taking place. That person, that culture, that city that rejects it is going to be worse off in the judgment than a bunch of perverts living back in Abraham's day. Do you understand how valuable truth is to God? How necessary it is that we receive truth, that we believe truth, and we respond accordingly to truth. And so I think that as we go to prayer, we should be praying today that, Lord, that His truth would make an impact upon our hearts and that we would not find ourselves in a worse shape than, I mean, imagine what Sodom's got coming. And yet if we reject the truth of the gospel, we got something worse coming our way. So I think we need to pray for those in our family, need to pray for those in our circle of friends that are currently rejectors, and pray that God would do for them the very same thing that He did for the idiot Lot. He drug them out of there. And we need to pray that God will drag them out of their blindness and out of their lack of urgency, and that they would come to know the Lord.